So, Mr. Weiss, did you have good asparagus this afternoon, or this evening?
No.
No asparagus? Smell like asparagus in the bathroom. No? You have asparagus pee for some reason.
Don't know what to tell you.
And I was curious if it came from the United States or if it's still coming from Mexico and stuff. But since you have asparagus, because it's March, so it's not necessarily going to be South American anymore. It might be Central American.
Okay.
But you didn't have asparagus, so never mind.
No, it's just the character of my pee.
Normally, I don't smell anything particular when I pee after right, Greg.
Let me get into valve structure, because I think it's kind of interesting. I'm going to have this first. This is the Black Diamond. Valve has a really interesting structure. Aside from maybe one or two or three people, their corporate structure is flat in the sense they don't have managers. They don't have that sort of... They don't have regular teams. People can switch mm-hmm. teams when they want to.
Okay.
They supervise each other. They go into their separate areas and they play on. They do what they want to do. It's a really interesting company and a really interesting structure, and it works for them. I don't know that it works. That it will work for every organization. They pick the most talented people out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that when you do that, you know, and you just bring the most talented people together and you have them make stuff, you end up making good things.
So I know Valve for Half-Life.
Yes.
What are their other big titles other than Half-Life 2 and...
Left 4 Dead, Portal.
Oh, that's right, Portal, okay.
In terms of their bad games, they had a game called Ricochet, which didn't really work out too well for them. But Left 4 Dead is a huge one. They have...
I'm not even familiar with that one.
It's a zombie game that... Okay. It's a zombie cooperative game. What's the new one that they have? It's AO... Team Fortress is one of their... You know, it's their online game. Portal's a big one. Portal is just an amazing experience.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them. Funny as hell, too. Absolutely one of the funniest games you'll ever play.
Really?
Yeah.
I have Portal. Like, long after it was released, they had a special sale weekend, or maybe even free weekend, and I got it then. But like, I don't even have the Steam stuff installed right now. But I should reinstall it and play Portal more, I guess.
Yeah, no, it's really a cool experience, and it's really funny. And even the second one, you know, just amps that up by getting like Steven Merchant along to play a character, and it's really really cool.
Half-Life was a revolutionary game. I mean, that was
Half-Life changed the industry. Half-Life is one of those industry-changing games. It's you know, like Star Wars changed movies, Half-Life changed games. And there have been other revolutions afterwards, but Half-Life made a very important impact at the time.
It was such a long story compared to other games of the time.
Well, I mean, the story itself people often comment on this. The story itself was pretty simplistic in the sense that, okay, it was just... You are a dude. You get attacked by some nefarious force, and you try to defeat it. That part of the story is relatively simplistic, but the details they put in, the little things that you could skip or see, all the little parts,
mm-hmm.
all the little things that games like Quake or Doom or stuff skip, Valve made sure that were there.
If you look back at Quake, right? I mean, it was more or less Quake, Doom, mm-hmm. Castle Wolfenstein was grinding, right?
Right, yeah.
You know, there was really no advancement other than it just got harder and harder and harder, you know?
But like in Half-Life, there was a resemblance between the creatures. There was a clear sort of hierarchy going on. There was... there was all these little details. There was stuff that you slowly found out as you moved along in the game.
Duke Nukem had some of that, didn't it?
Duke Nukem?
It did. Single player Duke. Have you ever played single player Duke
Yeah,
Nukem?
Yeah, yeah.
It had
yeah.
some storyline progression
it
and
was
stuff.
Kinda, it was so silly and just kind of... So, you know what it was like? It was like Commando. Remember that Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, Commando?
Mm-hmm.
It was just so, so ridiculously fucking silly that you're just like, oh, right. I get it. I mean, I'd like to... I haven't watched Commando in a long time. It'd be fun to watch it again. But at the same time, throw insults back at it while you're watching it. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, come on, it's fucking Commando. It's not...
I just remember playing Duke Nukem after playing Doom and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't this repetitive dungeon grind, right? And it was the next... It was a step.
It was an incremental step, but Valve with Half-Life was a real leap.
Mm-hmm.
Was a real this is something new you're trying here. You're instead of doing this level by level progression where there's text between the levels,
mm-hmm.
it's just one straight thing, and
right.
you are inside this game. You are in this environment, and. That's. I mean, there was so many different revolutionary touches that they put in there that really made the game.
Let's start off with the crowbar.
That's nothing new, because you start off with a knife, or you start off with a tiny pistol, or you start off with a wrench or something.
But not a crowbar. Wrench? Who starts you off with a wrench?
System Shock.
No, okay, I'm not familiar with that one.
Okay. It's a great game. System Shock 2 especially was amazing. Amazing game. Not funny. But scary. Scary as hell. Really fucking awesome game. System Shock 2. Great game. Okay. Wow, this is a big topic. Well, okay, well, hey, before we go on to anything further, it's time for Amazon Anonymous.
Ooh, Amazon Anonymous. That's my worst voice I can muster.
Okay. So, have you found anything interesting yet? I mean...
I really haven't checked this past
okay,
week,
so take so. A look and see if you can find something interesting. I have...
I mean, I did see that someone bought those LED light bulbs.
Damn it.
Oh, is that your thing?
Yeah, that's my thing.
Do it! Do it! Do it.
Okay.
That's not a spoil. You can talk about
no,
it now.
Right. You're right. You're right. Okay. But I don't know if you were going to pick that one.
No, I'll pick something else.
Okay. So someone purchased Ecolite High Power 24 Watt LED Par 38 Wide Flood 60 Degree Soft White Light Bulb from Ecolite. This is a pretty expensive thing. It's $50.
What's the wattage on those?
24.
So you get like 100 watt spotlight. No, probably get more than like a 200 watt spotlight
for 24 watts.
For 24 yeah. watts, yeah.
Yeah, I mean it's a you know you pay initially for the cost of the thing, but then you don't pay for the electricity.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really cool. It's you know it's a good way. It's like those you know before they had a pretty you know small compact CFLs, the compact fluorescents. Fluorescent lights are pretty expensive, but as they got more and more popular, they went down in price. Price elasticity of demand. But these LED lights are the next big thing. And this cost will certainly come down, but it'll pay for itself in the long run in terms of electricity costs, that's for sure. So good purchase, anonymous user.
All right, so I have to give kudos to the person who bought the Xylus stoppers. Set
right.
of six Xylus stoppers. That'll last them because they probably won't have six open big bottles of beer. Someone's shopping for a birthday party. That's going to be my pick of the week.
Okay. Well, a birthday party of a certain quality.
I would say a 2 or 3 year old boy who likes dinosaurs a lot. Dinosaur train! Dinosaur Train!
What is this that you're saying?
It's a show on PBS, Dinosaur Train. Oh. It's an educational show about dinosaurs. And they have the Dinosaur Train, Dinosaur Express, cake topper for $8.
All right, hold on. I need to close the door for a second, but I need to ask you a question. Because right. I'm concerned about this show on PBS about dinosaurs. Because I want to know...
You want to know...
The dinosaurs have feathers or not?
I think some of them do have feathers, but most of them do not.
It's wrong.
We've talked about this before. There is the main characters are pteranodons, pterosaurs of sorts, feathers. And
nearly all dinosaurs had feathers, as it turns out.
And one of the dinosaurs is not a pteranodon, but ended up in the nest, and the pteranodon mother raised him as one of their own. It's a very nice story. There's a lot of educational stuff about dinosaurs in there. There are feathers, but probably not enough feathers to make you happy. You could download the PBS Kids app on your phone and watch Dinosaur Train as much as you want for free. My kids like Dinosaur Train, so this hit me in a soft spot here. So, Dinosaur Train! Dinosaur Train! I don't know the rest of the words.
That's more than enough. Yeah, so somebody was definitely hunting for dinosaur stuff.
So, yeah, this is the dinosaur that's raised by the Tyrannosaur mom.
That would definitely, especially the youthful versions, would certainly have feathers. Yep. Dinosaurs were covered in feathers. Believe it, guys, they were giant chickens with toothy mouths.
So someone had a dinosaur party. They bought stamps, they bought a big party sign, they bought all dinosaur theme. Amazon Anonymous week. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And like we said, Xylus. But that's Amazon Anonymous for this week. Thank you so much.
Ooh, someone else bought a different kind of bottles, wine bottle stuff, right?
You're getting into save for a different
I was time. Looking at these. I was wondering if they were as good as Xylus.
It might be. Somebody tried something different. These Peretti wine and
they're about bar. The same price, though.
Yeah.
So I see, I'm so happy with Xylus, I'm not willing to switch for the same price.
No, I think it's worth a shot. The cover is interesting in terms of how it...
They make a Xylus that does that, where it's the same as this one here, but it goes down, has a sleeve, if it goes about this far.
Yeah.
It's almost like a foreskin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what the point is.
I think it's probably more psychological than anything else. Because, yeah, I mean, you know, air is... If it's going to be released, it's the little sleeve there, the 2-inch sleeve, is not really going to protect it that much. But it's a psychological
thing. Maybe it makes it more sensitive.
Like a foreskin.
Exactly. Right. And Greg hates when I dive into Amazon Anonymous too much, so I will shut up.
Well, I just don't want... I mean, I don't want to get to the point where we run out of Amazon. It's because I like the
that
feature.
Kid's going to have a hell of a dinosaur party, though.
Yeah.
There is a dinosaur. That's like... This is like 1970s like rock t-shirt, yeah. Dinosaur shirt, you know? It's black t-shirt with a silk screen all over the whole thing. It's awesome. Thank you again for...
It needs to have three dinosaurs on it, like the three wolf t-shirt.
Thank you for using our Amazon. craftperiod.com/Amazon. You're going to spend the money anyway. Give us a kickback.
Wormholes?
Wormholes.
We talked about Michio Kaku last week, and
yes, we love the Michio Kaku.
People,
I love the Kaku.
People kind of wonder why I'm so down on Michio Kaku, and it's because.
Did someone ask, or are you just presuming the people?
I'm presuming. To be totally honest, I'm presuming, but it's because he loves talking about wormholes. Loves talking about wormholes. And a person of his knowledge and with his grasp of science should understand what wormholes actually are. Now, yes, they're a solution to the Einstein equation. They're a solution to Einstein field equations. Originally, Einstein-Rosen bridges is what they were called. But they called wormholes because that sounds cooler than Einstein-Rosen bridge. But the idea is that you have a solution to the field metric where you can have two points in space-time that connect to each other, even though they may be separate from a distance. But remember, this is still based on Einsteinian relativity, Einsteinian metrics. Causality is still preserved. How can you do that if your positions are different in light speed? Well, because wormholes don't operate, they are not a tunnel. It's incredibly important to understand this. Wormholes are not a tunnel. They are. If they're a tunnel,
they're more of a portal, right?
Well, they're a tunnel to oblivion. In the sense that, okay, number one.
So if you call it a portal instead of a tunnel, right, where there's not a dimension between the openings. You know, talking about whole bending space-time. So two points come in contact and can open a portal.
Right.
Is that better?
No.
Okay.
They're sort of like really tiny black holes that have a connection point in the center. But the important thing to understand about black holes and wormholes, too, is that nothing gets out. Nothing can travel from point one to point two. You can go to the center, and that's it.
Nothing?
Nothing.
I mean, a spaceship can't, but not even...
Nothing.
Okay.
Nothing.
So you can get from two separate points to the same place.
You can connect two separate points in a space-time metric to each other via a wormhole, but nothing can actually travel through to another.
What I want to say is, you're sitting over there, you know, 3.5 whole feet away from me.
Right.
And I'm over here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just too much effort to send this particle all the way to you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to do it. I would much rather create a wormhole where it's right here. And I think what you're saying, tell me if I'm wrong, is I can send a particle in the wormhole, and you can send a particle in the wormhole, and they'll meet, but I can't send a particle to you.
Well, number one, you can't create them. At least no way that we know how to create them. Okay, so this is getting into speculative stuff. Maybe we can find a way to create them. Number two, a wormhole
just happens to manifest itself out of
obscene
odds.
Right. Number two, they're submicroscopic and they're almost instantaneously destroyed. In order to make something traversable, you'd have to use ridiculous stuff that doesn't actually happen in Einstein's equations.
You're no fun. Where's your fun?
Well, I mean,
Brian Greene's fun.
Exactly. That's why I'm so down on Kaku and Brian Greene doesn't talk about wormholes really. He's more about structure of matter.
Sure.
It's not
okay.
About,
Kaku's fun. Well, Kaku. He's fun when he's well produced in a Nova special.
Yeah.
When he's on an interview show like Colbert, he's not fun. He sounds not as smart.
Kaku is Star Trek. Star Trek is fun. Star Wars is fun. I agree. But it's not possible.
If inventors listened to you, nothing would get invented because they would know it's not possible.
There's a difference. There's a huge difference. I understand where you're coming from, but like... You know, there's this common myth that, people said the speed of sound would never be broken. What did I say? The speed of sound? Did I say
that? You said the speed of sound.
Okay.
The speed of sound.
Wanted to clarify. Need a little bit more water. People said the speed of sound would never be broken. No, they did. I mean, maybe a few people did, but most people realized, the speed of sound could probably be broken.
People thought going 40 miles an hour would rip the skin off your face.
Right. It was more a mechanical problem than it was a physical problem, a problem with physicality. There was nothing that said that going faster than the speed of sound was impossible. In fact, we knew that things traveled faster than the speed of sound. Light, for instance, we knew traveled faster than the speed of sound. So clearly things could travel faster than the speed of sound. It was a question of whether things could maintain structural integrity, whether you could keep something together.
All right. I mean, is it? I think you're distilling a little too much. Can I? I think you're getting to it, but when they say, "We don't know if we could go faster than the speed of sound," I'm talking about a macroscopic object that.
No, well, you're talking about structural problems. I mean, clearly things could go faster than the speed of sound. We knew that things could go faster than the speed of sound. light, for instance.
But that's the only thing that we could observe.
There were, I mean,
nothing that was...
Clearly, things in space were moving faster than the speed of sound. And
that wasn't in the atmosphere.
But it wasn't in the atmosphere. Right. But it was,
I mean, you could see where even smart scientists could
but,
conceive.
But
that
there wasn't smart scientists who were saying it was impossible.
There could be this pressure wall.
There were people who were saying that it might be, it may be impossible mechanically to do it to keep things together. But we figured out a way to do it. But people aren't saying that there might be a way mechanically that mechanically structures.
It's
not a mechanical problem. It's a way the universe is structured problem. The universe doesn't allow it. It's simply a fact.
I understand. What I want to say is that I think it's conceivable. No, I'm not a fluid. You know, dynamic fluid physicist or anything, but what if the pressure, you know, the sound pressure wave at speed of sound was 1,000 times greater than it is, right? Then it would be not technically like the universal speed limit of the speed of light, where matter can't travel faster, but it mechanically it would be.
Really, virtually impossible. Really hard. Yes.
So, I mean, I think that's. I think it's a matter of semantics, right? And I think.
Well, the point is, though, that understanding there's a difference between the mechanics of the problem and.
But the things you're quoting, maybe it was the.
Well, no, but there are people who are saying, well, I mean, there are people who will say things like, well,
there were bullets.
People said the speed of sound couldn't be broken, and now people are saying the speed of light can't be broken. Speed of sound was broken, so how do we know the speed of light can't be broken? Well, because...
Oh, here's an easy one. I don't know
Well, the reason is because they're different problems.
Well, sure.
That's the point I'm trying
but,
to make.
But I mean, even when people were saying you can't take a human in an airplane faster than the speed of sound, there were bullets that they knew were going faster than the speed of sound.
Right.
So a solid lead object can. So it's certainly a mechanical thing, but you got to make sure you phrase the problem the right way and things like that. So, I mean, because sure, in the Civil War, you know, lead balls might not have been going faster than 700 and some miles an hour. I'm not sure, but certainly by World War I, there were supersonic bullets, you know?
Yes.
So.
Yeah, no, it's not a question of, oh, well, we just don't have the technology. It's a simple matter of the way the universe works. And when I say simple, I mean it. I mean simple. It really is quite simple. In fact, relativity itself, at least special relativity, you can learn... It just takes a few kind of core concepts and trigonometry. That's all you need. That's really all you need to understand special relativity. And some amazing and crazy things can come out of that. But you don't need much school learning to get it. I mean, you don't. You really don't need that much. You need to know Pythagoras' theorem. And that's essentially it. To really... And then just sort of expand your mind and grasp these interesting concepts. And special relativity provides this whole landscape for how time works. And then general relativity gets into gravity and the math gets ridiculous. Mm-hmm. The math just gets to be right. Incredibly crazy and out there. But still... weirdly, crazily elegant. And the interesting thing about that is that, so, okay, you have general relativity on this one side that's just, it's like the math is crazy hard, and but weirdly, strangely elegant. And then you have, okay, you have quantum mechanics, and it's this like hodgepodge just kind of thrown together, the standard model. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really make much sense, but it works extremely well. I mean, the interesting thing about relativity is that, you know, it's this wonderful sort of beautiful mechanical theory, and once you understand the math behind it, it all makes sense, and it's really very, very pretty. But it doesn't really... It affects things that are pretty much beyond us. Things that are much larger than us are really the stuff that's actually affected by general relativity. But the stuff that we are affected by, the stuff that we notice, the stuff that we have used... The only thing that general relativity is really used for in terms of stuff that we use every day is GPS. Everything else is quantum mechanics. And the weird thing is quantum mechanics is so much more accurate than general relativity.
I would revise your statement. Where maybe it's... there's quantum mechanics for computers and stuff. But, I mean, when you say what we use every day, that's Newtonian.
No. What we use every day in terms of now. I mean, what we use every day in the 17th, 18th century, and maybe some of the 19th century, was definitely Newtonian. But what we use, which is a special case of special relativity, which is a special case of general relativity. But what we use in terms of today, where we have computers and we have communications and we have LCD
screens. People still throw baseballs.
Yeah, people still throw baseballs, but we also do things like thermodynamics, which actually comes down to fundamental quantum mechanical principles. We do things like any heat exchange is fundamentally a thermodynamic operation, and that's most of what our society is built upon. And certainly any information exchange is built upon quantum dynamics. Our society is built upon quantum mechanics. And the weird thing is that quantum mechanics, as much as it's an ad hoc, thrown together kind of weird system that has these weird rules and is not nearly as pretty as general relativity, it works better. It's so odd that this really pretty thing that we can explain in this small equation works so much more poorly than this large, ridiculous thing that we've hodgepodge and thrown together, which is just so ridiculously accurate. And that's kind of the weird schism that's going on in science right now. And that's why people are trying... That's why string theory has come about. That's why quantum loop quantum gravity has come about. People are trying to figure out, well, how do these two mix together? And right now they don't. They just don't.
All right, I got something for you.
All right.
Zombies. Now wait. Craig is staring at the wall like I just punched, like he just fell asleep. Not expand zombies to any kind of thing that'll disrupt normal society. How long would it?
Listen.
Here's what I'm getting. And stop. Give me a second.
Wait. Hold on. Okay. Before you do that, let's do a bathroom break. Because, yeah.
All right. We're back. Zombies, motherfucker.
Well, we just posted to Vine, we should say, a picture of me and my...
Doug Durda saw it already. He's like, wait, he can swear? Shit's getting real now.
I'm in my 8-bit tie. I didn't mention that. We didn't mention this before. I decided to wear my 8-bit tie today. And I have a shaving scar. And we find it.
And Father Spoon, who wears a priest thingamajig, doesn't like your swearing.
Well, you know, fuck him. So, zombies.
So, not zombies, relative to zombies, is the disruption in society and the loss of knowledge.
So you're not talking about zombies so much as you're talking about...
It could be a meteor strike.
You're talking about devastation. You're talking about... Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Right. It was just a hyperbolic lead-in,
right.
I guess.
Okay.
I mean, I was thinking about this today, and it really would not take much for all kinds of information to be lost.
Yes. No, nuclear bomb and the EMP. Nuclear bomb in the atmosphere.
But, like, think medical. Like how to do simple things. Like, administer anesthesia. I mean, how many years would it take for that information to be lost forever?
The weird thing is, I just read an article about that yesterday. Not about medicine, but about making a can of Coke. And how there's no one person who knows how to do all the things that go into making a can of Coke. You got to take bauxite out. You got to use different types of acids and stuff to take the to get the aluminum, and then you got to roll it and ship it to a different place, and then roll it out and cut it, and then put different polymers on it, put different paints on it. Then you got to make the syrup, which is a caustic combination of different colors and color combinations and flavors, and inject it with carbon dioxide. Throw it into your shaped can now. Put the other part of the can on with the right perforate. There's so much that goes into mm-hmm. just making a can of Coke. That, I mean, to well, make things a, like
a guy tried iPods to, or a guy or, tried to make a toaster from dirt.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we talked about that before. He couldn't do it. You know, he the heating elements, trying to smelt his own ore and make the heating elements, he couldn't make one, his attempt, and granted, it wasn't his life's work, but his attempt, he couldn't make an element that would work long enough to toast bread. It'd burn out.
Right. Now, I mean, would he be given 3 or 4 years to work on the problem? I'm sure he'd figure it out. A toaster is a relatively easy appliance. I mean, I doubt...
No, he spent a long time working on the toaster.
Yeah, but it wasn't his main job. His job was not to make a toaster.
His job was to write a story about trying to make a toaster.
But...
there's other ways to toast bread. I mean, that's part of the problem. But, I mean, it's a simple machine. But just showing the technology that goes into making a toaster.
Right.
The bimetal strip that works as the timer to pop the thing, Making a metal that can conduct electricity and generate heat and not burn itself out, all this stuff it almost makes you want to be a prepper. I mean, because the system is so fragile that like ridiculous amounts of knowledge can be lost by a relatively small event.
Yes.
You disrupt the learning sequence, 12 years, 15 years, 20 years of people not going to college, where no one can go to college. Imagine how far back that would set us. Not the college learning to think outside the box stuff, but just the institutional knowledge, the apprentice type stuff, right? You wouldn't have medical, you wouldn't have all this engineering stuff, you wouldn't have people were worried about surviving. I mean, it's almost Stone Age.
In fact, there are things like, in terms of NASA wanting to expand beyond low Earth orbit, most of the people who were involved in that operation in getting to the moon and stuff are not there anymore or dead. There's even just that small. Mm-hmm. Of a distance, if you want to do something that you've maybe done in the past before, but just have neglected, and you have not furthered that or kept that knowledge going, it's almost lost. You have to rediscover it again.
Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine something really happened where people weren't even learning much, much more simple things. Mm-hmm. I mean, just imagine, like I said, anesthesia.
Mm.
That could be lost real quick.
Wow.
What else could be lost?
I hope that people could still figure out how to make ether. I mean...
But it would still... How many hundreds of years would that... Or maybe it'd take you back 100 years.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be the stuff we have now, the good stuff.
That would be take a swig of whiskey and bite down on this leather belt.
Yeah. It would be a little bit better than that, but it wouldn't be proposanol or whatever they have, the really good stuff that just mm-hmm. takes your memory out completely.
I mean, there's just so many things that could be forgotten in a matter of years.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like, someone at work was telling me, he likes The Walking Dead. I like The Walking Dead. He's reading a series of books that are more set 50 years or something after the zombie apocalypse, where your life is not threatened by zombies every day. But it's about that, and that's kind of fascinating to me.
Yeah,
it's not about zombies. It's about society recovering from a disaster, zombies or whatever. And I think I want to read these books. I mean, if they're good, right? But that plot really intrigues me. It's like what Revolution could have been.
The Show Revolution. Or Jericho. Yeah. That was another one, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, everyone sees, and if you're doing a TV show with a questionable runtime and stuff, you know, you definitely want to get the big bang. You want the apocalypse. I want to see the story couple generations after the apocalypse.
After the apocalypse is, to you and me both, a lot more interesting.
But not the Mad Max or the one Will Smith was in. You know, not that kind of apocalypse, but more of the zombie apocalypse. I don't know why. It just seems...
Well, The Stand is... Well,
the,
like,
Stand. The Stand is good. What was Will Smith's movie? The Book of...
No, you're thinking the Book of Eli. That's different. Eli. No, that was Denzel Washington.
Oh, Denzel Washington. That's right.
Will Smith was I Am Legend, which is
That was in the apocalypse still. It wasn't beyond, right? Because your life is still threatened.
The movie was really different than the book. First of all, in the book, it's not zombies, it's vampires.
But, I mean, but for the I Am Legend, your life was still threatened daily.
Yes.
You know, and I am more fascinated by the, okay, your life's not threatened daily.
How do you rebuild?
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, weirdly, Game of Thrones is kind of about that. Okay. In a weird kind of way. Because, you know, I said that, you know, Revolution, Game of Thrones, the same sort of premise. There was some sort of magic in the world. It was lost, and then it's slowly coming back. Now, in Game of Thrones, it's actual magic. Mm-hmm. But still, there was a period of time where there was magic, and it was pretty much lost, sort of a medieval
time. Well, I mean, I don't disagree. I could definitely see how Revolution is technological magic, mm-hmm. right? Internet, computers, phones, mm-hmm. light bulbs, you know? And it doesn't work anymore.
Right.
And, yeah, I mean, so Revolution takes place 10, 12 years after the blackout, right? There is a lot of institutional knowledge lost.
Right. You know, Game of Thrones takes place like 300 years after the blackout.
So how does Game of Thrones make the magic as vital to that generation's culture, that generation's society, as technology is to our society?
It's not.
Okay.
It wasn't as vital, except in sort of the realm of conquering. It was a much easier way to conquer when you had dragons and kind of magic.
I see.
And once the dragons sort of return, magic starts to tune up again.
Do you want any more of this?
No, I'm good. Magic starts to tune up again, bit by bit. But
I hear the boobies do too.
Well, the boobies were always there, in theory. But there's still, I mean, magic affects the realm in various ways. I mean, it's not like magic is completely gone, but accessible magic or magic that people saw went away for the most part. The magic to build the wall, the magic stuff that's beyond the wall, the White Walkers, the others, that sort of thing.
I see. Yeah, so that rebuilding society thing. And I'm going to have to ask guy at work what these books he's reading. I can't remember the name. I kind of like zombie apocalypse and after zombie apocalypse. I don't know. Even though I do have my issues with Walking Dead. But it is a TV show, so you're going to have issues with it.
I heard that the most recent episode was really, really good.
Most recent episode. Last couple have been good. My biggest problem so far this season... Did we talk about this about the... No, I don't think we talked about this on the show.
Nope.
So there's a town where the governor lives, you know, the mean, evil villain guy. And, you know, they have it all walled off, and they're living a fairly good life. But, you know, resources are still scant. And they have a street that's divided with a green space down the center. And there's trees. And between trees, there's tree, garden box, you know, they're growing some vegetables, tree, solar panels. Tree, garden box, tree, solar panels. And why the fuck don't they put the solar panels up on the roofs of the buildings that are on both sides of the road and put more garden in and cut down the fucking trees? You know, it's...
Yeah, maybe they're trying to tell a visual story.
And it's also it's a real town. It's a real main street that they closed down for filming of The Walking Dead. One of my coworkers lives in Georgia, and he mentioned he went to dinner at one of the restaurants that's on that street. And the front windows were all plywooded up, and he had to go in through the back door to go to the restaurant and stuff like that. You know, so there, you know, you can't destroy this great old town main street, you know. Because it's a really nice looking town. But yeah, it's just like...
So my guess is a budget. I mean, because if you had an unlimited budget, you could composite solar cells on top of all the buildings and not have to worry about that thing. So, but it's easier to put, you know...
It's a cue that, oh, they're using solar. But they're putting solar where they could be putting a garden.
Yeah,
and the solar could be on the roof where you can't put a garden.
I mean, I understand why you'd have that problem, but also I understand why that would be something like, you know... We want to point out that we're using solar, but we can't.
How did they source the solar cells after the zombie apocalypse?
I don't know. Maybe Georgia has an excess of silicon. I don't know. It's not that hard to make a solar cell, to be honest.
They're the real shit.
The chemical components of
and they're not a, they're not hodgepodge mismatched. They were solar cells built to order to fit this frame. Yeah. So.
I mean, the chemical components of a marginally effective solar cell are relatively easy to make. A complex solar cell, one that really works well, is definitely harder to make. One that's, you know, manufactured is definitely harder to make. But you could make a pretty easy solar cell with a couple things, a couple chemicals, really. It's not that hard. It would not be very efficient, but it would not be that hard.
So we're on TV. I'm working my way through the second season of The Wire. I like the second season a lot better than the first. It's the one where they're doing the
Where's shipping. Wallace? Where's Wallace, String? That was in the first season. I'm almost
Where's
certain that
Wallace,
was
in... String?
Because, what's his name?
So, yeah, Devon is asking Stringer Bell.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Where's
yeah,
Wallace?
Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah, I saw that. The second season's where the shipping container's down on the port, and you know the characters, you know, like, I have a hard time thinking of names of all this beer right now, but I found it watchable, you know, and worth continuing after about six episodes, like you said, but I wasn't so hooked. I think, you know, starting the second season and getting like three episodes into the second season is kind of where I'm like, okay, yeah, now I'm going to watch another episode of this instead of something else. You know, now
I think because, you know, I see where you're coming from, and it's why The Wire was not, people didn't say in the first season of The Wire, this is the best show ever on TV. People said after like the fourth season of Wire, this is the best show on TV because it keeps expanding where it's going, and it keeps, you know,
like in the second season, they're showing the shipping containers, which is the main storyline, but they still go back to the towers in the low rises, you know, which is the center of the first season, right? And I don't know how they're going to tie it back in, but you can only presume it's going to tie, or maybe fourth or fifth season, there's going to be a major plot point that is in the low rise.
Well, no, I mean, what The Wire is about is that there are major systemic problems in all the systems, and yet there are major bureaucracies in all the systems that prevent the systemic problems from getting solved. And that's what The Wire is about. That's the story of The Wire.
Okay.
And
you just spoiled the whole fucking thing now.
And that's what gets exposed from the police to the drug trade to you're seeing the shipping stuff. You'll see politics. You'll see schools. You'll see news. But that same
thing. It's getting apparent with the police, right? Because I'm at the point where Valchek has the crew from the first season back together, investigating some bullshit thing. You know, and it's like, so that the police part's been exposed. The drug part, you know, Stringer Bell's group is, they're not selling so well. They're trying, you know, he's using some market things to trying to like rebrand themselves. But you don't see the systemic problems in the drug trade yet. But now that you told me that, I see where they're going, right? So that's cool.
Yeah, I know. It's about... It's really... I mean, The Wire is superficially a police show, but it's really about society. It's about how we organize ourselves and the pratfalls of that. Hmm. And that's why it's so great, because it, you know, it puts on this face of a TV show about one thing, but it's such a grand sort of expose about everything.
Right. Yeah. But, I've got to the point where, you know, I'm going to see it through unless something really turns me off, but it sounds like it just gets better from here.
Yeah.
It took me a little longer than your recommendation of like 5 or 6 episodes. It probably took 15 episodes, but
okay. Well, I mean, 5 or 6 episodes are to me enough to keep going. To me enough to see it.
Episodes without your recommendation, I might not have kept going. Actually,
okay. Well, but
right.
Eventually you start to see. Oh. Yeah. To me, the point where The Wire really, really started to, check in, I think was when Prez figures out the code.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that part was a cool moment. That part was fun.
Because, you know, like, here's this guy who's been shit on for 8 episodes, and then he discovers something cool and he turns.
Yeah. Well, it was a neat transition. Like it's almost with such huge casts and you're new to a show. At first, I didn't realize it was the same guy that was like sidelined because he cold cocked the guy with the gun at the beginning, right? And now he's really good at sitting in the office analyzing wiretaps and stuff like that, you know. And it made him turn from an a-hole bad cop to a really good detective,
right?
You know, and so that was pretty cool. And I didn't realize it was the same character at first. Just like a lot of that happens in The Sopranos. You know, where like character goes away, character comes back. I wasn't playing super close attention. I didn't realize it was the same character. You know, things like that.
Yeah, but that sort of thing happens all the time. I mean, characters have many, many arcs, and some go places that you would not expect, and some go places you entirely would expect. But most of the time, it's places you would not expect.
Well, it's like, you know, what's his name? Who's the black cop in the tweed jacket? What's his name? The one that builds the furniture.
Oh, Lester Freeman.
Lester, yeah. You know, he starts out, he's waiting for retirement, he's building toy furniture, he's no good cop. And then, you know, he turns into a really good cop about halfway through the season, and, you know, where I'm at now, he's still a really good cop, you know. You don't see him as a slacker. They started out portraying him. You know, maybe that's a gimme. That was a pretty easy transition as opposed to the one you just mentioned with, what's his name?
Prez. Prez Belusky.
Curiosity.
Had to switch to their B computer.
But I think they're going to be able to fix their A computer, right?
They think. I mean, the working theory right now is that a cosmic ray hit the memory. That's a kind of crazy-ass theory, if you ask me. I mean, because it's just the potential that is so ridiculously small. It's absolutely
the
possible.
The odds of it happening on a specific mission on Mars is low.
Yeah.
Odds of it happening in general is not... So,
like, I remember when they had a similar problem that they noticed on with either Spirit or Opportunity, and they thought one of the first possible explanations was the cosmic ray. And it turned out they were addressing their memory wrong. There was a way they were doing things that was wrong.
That was right when they landed, right where they thought they were bricked at first.
Yeah, there was something like that happened with it might have been Opportunity actually. But
memory card was full, basically.
Yeah, essentially. So it wouldn't surprise me if a similar thing happened. on Mars.
Well, this was more of a redundancy check, right? Yeah. Like where a checksum didn't line up.
Yeah. Or it could be just, you know, a piece of the memory just doesn't work, and so but they have good enough code they can just, okay, don't use that address. And
I actually read the most detail about it. I didn't go seeking out space science news. I was reading a security blog that I read, and they were taking more of a use case of always validate your inputs and things like that, right? Uh-huh. So, like, you know, obviously, or not obviously, but, you know, supposedly, you know, writing code for curiosity, you're just writing a certain module. You know, you're going to take your input, and you're going to validate it to check for cosmic interference, you know, things like that, right? You can't assume your input's going to be sanitized.
Well, that's what they did. I mean, yeah. That's exactly how it worked, is that they immediately noticed a problem and went into safe mode immediately and started to figure out what the problem was, and in the meantime switched over their secondary computer so they could analyze the problem. So, I mean, they did that. They did that, I think, as well as you can do with current technology and right. with current ideas. So it was not a... It was not a mistake on their part. It was very much, okay, we are ready for this sort of stuff. We want to see what happens. But, you know, it's going to be interesting. Parents, here's an interesting thing. Remember when your parents told you life wasn't fair?
I don't think I recall such a thing.
Your parents never told you life isn't fair. When you said, that's not fair, like when you were, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or 11.
I have no recollection.
And they would say, life isn't fair. And you're like, what? And you're young, and you're rebelling against them for a while because you're like, what do you mean life isn't fair? That doesn't make sense. That doesn't jive with what you've been throwing at me. And you really don't realize it until you're 30. So yeah, life isn't fair. I mean, in your 20s, you're rebelling against everything, and you're trying a bunch of new things, and you're still kind of experimenting with what your personality really is. And I don't think until you get into your 30s that you really sort of kind of nail it down. And you're like, yeah, life isn't fair. But then you look at your parents, and you're like, okay, you guys made me, right? You brought me into this world that you knew was unfair. You knew it. And you brought me in anyway, and now you're judging me on it? Yeah, thanks a lot.
I don't see it the same way, but I don't appreciate the whole point of view. I have no recollection of that moment where my parents told me life isn't fair. I'm not saying I would have never said something like that as a teenager, because I'm pretty sure I probably did. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to role play like how it would have came out and how I would have reacted, but I can't really get there. As far as bringing children into a world that's not fair.
Yes, let me ask you this question of somebody who has brought children into a world who, you know, the world is unfair. You know that your children are more likely to be used than to be users.
Okay, so a couple things here. Bringing children into a world that it's not fair was never really a consideration.
No, I imagine not.
Bringing children into a world that maybe... apocalyptic wasteland.
That's, you know, not what I'm talking about.
Well, either. No, but I mean, that was kind of a, like, if I was seriously thinking that, like, government's broken, America's in a decline, shit,
that's
like
not
that,
what I'm talking about.
I might have thought twice, but I figured there was enough stability in the system to bring some children into the world. Maybe a horrible mistake. We'll see.
Well, I'm saying you brought children into a world where they will most likely have to toil at some point.
I have a slightly different view.
They will not live a life full of, you know, of wonderful, lovey freedom for their entire lives. There will be points where
but I also think that my children will be advantaged over most of the population.
Why?
Why? Because they're brought into an upper middle class household. They get lots of attention, lots of love, lots of, and education will be important. I'm going to raise my children that you can't be, you know, that there is no future in the service industry and things like that. You need to make things. You need to be an engineer. You need to be, you know, so I'm going to put...
Well, that's just that's just the last 10 or 15 years. I mean,
it's going to get worse going forward.
Probably, but it's also probably going to change going forward into a different industry, a different way of...
Okay,
of,
but how can in being... inventive, smart, and inventing, you know, making things be bad in any future change? And
I don't know, right. But people didn't know 30 years ago that the computers were going to be the
economy. But now we do, and now we know it's all about, you know, thought jobs, about, you know, creating things.
But maybe 30 years from now, it'll be all about how you think about things and not about creating things.
You need to position yourself so you can't be outsourced, right? I mean, that's... because it's just going to be
easier. How can you not be outsourced? We're all humans.
We're less likely to be outsourced, right? If you are able to create stuff...
I don't understand what you mean. How can... We're all humans on the planet. Sure. We can all do the same things relatively. What do you mean not be outsourced?
A 5-year-old and a 2-year-old in 2013 still has an advantage over a 5-year-old and 2-year-old in India or China in 2013. In America, they...
How do you figure?
How do I figure?
Yes, how do you figure? I think there's a lot of assumptions you're making.
Give me a second here.
If you'd like a musical break, I'm ready.
Play the music.
Well, it's not turned up, so... Maybe they're in Xanadu.
Alright, so... I'm just going to pull that down a few decibels. There's no guarantees.
Right.
But if you're going to set your kid up for success, my opinion is... to be able to invent, create, make things that aren't there. And so, my kids are still very young. I may find this is a completely futile and ignorant stance that I have. But I'm going to direct my kids towards STEM type things. Science, technology, engineering, math.
And what if they don't want to go in?
I mean, if they don't want to go there, that's fine. But I'm going to tell Ellison that, you know...
I mean, okay, look, let me put
this way. Okay, let's do rope. Let's do some improv.
Well,
Right before we do, I
want to make this point, okay? My sister, okay... I think I'm smart. I think I'm a pretty smart guy. I think I'm above average intelligence. My sister is way smarter than me. Way more impressive than me in pretty much every way you can possibly think of. She went into a field that in general is not going to make nearly as much money as I do. Because that's what she was interested in. That's what she loved. It didn't matter. She knew that... if she were to do the kind of stuff that I would do, or if she were to go into law or something like that, like she was originally bound to go into, that was the stuff that was on her, you know, on her docket. That was where she was going, but she went to where she loved, and that was more important to her.
Can you change a kid's love? If you encourage STEM, I don't know. This is a question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you make any percent change in where they end up?
I don't
You provide this whole STEM environment, I think. Why aren't girls engineers? Girls aren't engineers, probably mostly because culture doesn't say girls can be engineers. I'm hoping Allison feels that girls can be engineers. No, if she doesn't want to be an engineer, that's fine. But I don't want her to think girls can't do math.
Right. Well, yeah, that's important. I mean, it's important, I think, for your children to be science literate in the sense that they understand how to look at the world. Right? They understand how to assess claims.
Nonetheless, your sister makes things.
Yes.
Your sister writes for a newspaper. She writes. She's an author. She's a journalist. Even better, right? She makes things. She creates things. She's not working retail, sales, something or another.
Right. No. It's true. She's in a creative position.
She's not in STEM.
No. In fact, she's making more than I am. But she's in Boston, so it's a different sort of.
But she's making things. She's creating things. She can't be outsourced is a very vague statement.
Right.
But she has value over. Retail salespeople are going to be automated in 20 years.
Yes. Yeah, you just wipe your phone
across
something.
McDonald's is not going to have a person working in the kitchen in 20 years.
You'll be able to, like, go to McDonald's, press a couple buttons, and boop, boop, there's your thing will come out. Sure, yeah.
So you need to have a person who can create things. Writing words on paper and selling them, or writing software. Or doing something.
If your daughter says, "I want to dance. I want to dance. That's what I love."
You better be prepared to work fucking hard.
But no,
that's still making stuff, though.
Yeah, but she's not really making stuff. She's performing.
She can, not necessarily.
Isn't it? I mean,
you don't have to perform Swan Lake and get acid poured on your face. You can do other things. You can make a new opera. You can write stuff. You can perform.
Well, that's if her creative juices flow in that direction, then sure. But that's not. But that's not everybody. Everybody's not like that. Everybody's not a creative person.
Can you foster that? Can you foster that? To what degree? And I am spending, my mission as a parent is to foster that creative make stuff, because that's how you're going to succeed in 30 years.
Is there evidence showing that's actually true? That actually does work? I mean, that this actually does foster creativity besides just sort of wishful thinking
Are you saying it's hurtful or a waste of effort?
I'm questioning the second thing. The first one, I'm not saying no, I don't believe it's hurtful, but I am questioning whether it's a waste of effort and whether you can truly control that sort of thing in your child.
Is it worth risking? I can sit back and say it doesn't matter.
That's the question. Is it worth risking? I mean, you've made the choice. You've done the deed. So the deed's already done. So okay.
So there's no research saying whether this will work or not. I can sit back and hope she succeeds, or I can do what I think's the best, which isn't hurtful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you give me an argument that pushing Allison towards STEM type career is hurtful.
I'm not. No.
Right. Why not do it?
Because it's not worth the effort.
It's my child.
Well, no. The only
it's
reason
that
I would say that maybe not pushing. I mean, I wouldn't say push towards that, because maybe that's not what she wants to do. And in terms of your child, isn't it more important?
I
that
don't
your
mean
child
push like Tiger Mom. I mean direct. I mean
expose is what you should do. Not necessarily direct or push, because what your child wants to do is what your child wants to do ultimately, and that's going to be influenced by a whole lot of things, including you, but not just you.
But from day one, if you encourage them, especially with Allison, girl, can't do math, can't be an engineer, stay at home mom. What is the harm of doing...
You're married to a stay-at-home mom.
I didn't get to start with Heather early enough.
so there's... But she's made it work.
Next...
Okay.
Back to Allison.
Back to Allison.
My child. Let's break some stereotypes. Let's let her never, at least as much as I can, at least as one father can help, make her not realize that girls can't do math. And see where it goes.
Well,
and also direct as much as I can that, this is where it's at. Math, science, engineering, technology. Is where it will always be. Technology is going to change and what that means. But it's where it's always going to be for the next several hundred years.
Understanding the world as best you can is the best way to
if you ask Allison right now what she wants to be, she'll probably tell you astronaut. And that's not me coaching her to say astronaut. Do I seriously think she'll become an astronaut? No. I don't.
Uh-huh.
But if...
That's a pretty rarefied feel.
it's not me coaching her saying, what's the answer to this question? Astronaut.
But almost everybody who becomes an astronaut wanted to be an astronaut. I mean, there's something to it, right? I mean, right. Clearly, thousands of people want to be astronauts, and 200 people make it. But those 200 people... almost all wanted to be astronauts.
Now, if you ask me, do I want my daughter to be an astronaut? No. If she is, sure. Do I want her to be in engineering? Yes. Mm. Right? I'm not going to say, anything adversely. Does a 4-year-old or 5-year-old even appreciate what an astronaut is? No.
No.
Why did she pick astronaut? I don't think I coached her to say astronaut.
The same reason why kids pick fireman or I asked Max what he wanted to be.
Farmer.
Yep.
Because they get to drive tractors. Because
they get to drive tractors. Now, I mean, that could be extended. I mean, if that keeps up, which almost certainly it won't be, but if that keeps up, then, he could get into mechanical engineering and certainly get a, really good job doing that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, what did I want to be when I grew up? I wanted to be an astronomer. Why? Because I was fascinated by
space. I wanted to be a chef.
Okay, all right. I can see that. Okay, so I wanted to be an astronomer. And why did I want to be an astronomer? Because I was fascinated by what was out there and how it all worked. And that kind of, as you see, sort of extends me further. You wanted to be a chef. You wanted to be sort of in control and yet have an idea of how things were moving along and working, right? So... You got that position. It was not in the same genre, but you still got there. So
I mean, this was what I wanted to be in third grade, right? Chef.
Yeah.
Maybe even earlier. Maybe even like kindergarten. I'm trying to think where that came from. But I have this thing embedded in my mind where I wrote on school papers, I want to be a chef and whatnot. This is somewhere between kindergarten and third grade.
You watch Top Chef?
Do I watch Top Chef?
I'm curious. I mean, since you wanted to be a chef, because I wanted to be an astronomer, I'm not an astronomer, but I still keep up with astronomy news, and I still keep up with that sort of stuff.
Actually, Heather watches a lot of those Chopped and type shows.
But you don't?
I catch them on occasion. I don't watch them regularly. I don't watch the elimination process and root for favorites in anything. I worked at a restaurant for years.
Right.
And food service, I know food service is not glamorous anymore. You know, it's like, I have no desire to work in food service.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about, I mean, food, okay, I think you and I both chose... So Damien was complaining the other day about programmers. This clues in, but he was complaining about how programmers are kind of short-sighted and don't look at their because he had to spend a whole bunch of time figuring out a problem that if he would have been able to if the programmers would have thought more along the lines of he would have been able to figure out much quicker. And so he was, you know, yelling at me because I'm a programmer, and he was saying, you know, why do programmers think this way? And it was like, you know, because we're presented with a problem, and of course we think about it the way we want to think, the way we would want to do it, the way that we see it. And if we're not directed to do it in a specific way, we're going to almost certainly do it that way. And I know from experience, from being in this sort of in this continuum, in this job sector for 12, 13 years, I know now what to look for. I know who to ask in terms of how to build things to work, you know, better. But when you know you're 3 or 5 years into it, you don't necessarily know that. But the point that I was trying to make to him is that as programmers, we really are artists. We're artists. We're making paintings, but once we make the painting, it's not up to us, nor do we care how the gallery is set up. That's not our problem. That's somebody else's problem. And I think
it's funny. Like, we're like on the same brainwave, because I was thinking about this just like not today, but like yesterday or 2 days ago, about programmers being artists. Unfortunately, you're tasked to solve a problem,
but we're tasked to solve a problem
creatively. We
have to do it creatively, right?
I think there's a fundamental difference between an artist and an engineer who needs to solve a problem creatively, and that is, you have, an artist doesn't have requirements of
absolutely. A problem an artist to solve. Has requirements.
They don't have a problem.
An artist, to
solve.
Okay, so you have an artist who usually has to fit into a certain genre in order for demand. I mean, only the most brilliant artists make their own genres, right? I mean, you get Picasso makes cubism.
I don't see being pigeonholed into a genre as. The same as
no, I think,
solving this.
I do. I think it's the same thing. You have a certain tactics that you can use. You have certain processes that you're familiar with. But there's still an art of putting it all together.
You have to create a feature, a specific feature with specific requirements.
But there's still an art of how to put it all together, how to connect it together. And that's not something that you can just throw into a machine and have it do. You can't just tell a machine, I wanted to do this, and have it do it. You have to have an artist do it. You have to have somebody do it. It's not a manufacturing job where you can have a robot putting divots into a screw table. It's not the same thing. There's artistry involved into making it work.
I disagree. There's engineering involved. There is solving a problem.
Why isn't engineering art?
There is some creative, but I chalk it up as a much lower percentage. It sounds like you're creative. Like, I would say, you know, an engineering job where you're programming is 5 to 10% art, and the rest solving, meeting the requirements of the task. And you're making it sound like it's much higher, 60% art.
I would say being immersed in this sort of thing, it is art. I mean, there's a lot of artistry to it, and I've been exposed to a whole bunch of different ways to solve the same problem. A whole myriad of ways. And they're always different. And no one uses the same way every time. And everyone has their own little flair. And everyone has their own little, you know, ways in which they do things.
Okay, so instead of an artist, how about a craftsman? Where you have your own techniques to do more practical things.
Isn't it the same? What's the difference? The difference is...
An artist doesn't have requirements.
The only difference is functionality, right? The only difference is...
But your job is providing functionality.
But, you know, an artist is providing functionality.
An artist's job is providing a feel.
No, yeah, functionality on an emotional level as opposed to a practical level. But it's still the same thing.
An artist doesn't set into a piece saying, I need a person to feel this way.
Yes, they do. That's absolutely what they do. An artist says, I want a person to feel this way. That's why I'm making this painting.
They don't know
that's
what the person's going to feel like.
Or that's why
done.
I'm writing this story.
It's so much
they're
more,
trying to express a feeling.
No, it's,
or they're
more
trying
fluid
to express something through
an
a song.
An artist will go
I
in.
Totally disagree with you here.
I'm going to call my artist friend Steve.
Okay. But no. an artist is trying to present a feeling, or they're trying to express themselves, or they're trying to, you know...
The artist is trying to invoke a feeling, not a specific feeling. An engineer needs to...
I disagree. I think an artist is definitely trying to provoke a specific feeling. Now, that might not always work, but the same thing with an engineer. An engineer is trying to make a specific thing that will work. It might not always work. But, you know, a good artist will get the job done. A good engineer will get the job done. It's the same thing. You're dealing with a slightly more complex bit of arrangement with an artist than you are with an engineer.
I'm not going to agree with this. I agree with some of your premise, but I think you're painting with a too wide of a brush.
Okay.
And obviously, neither of us are going to win this one. So let's move on.
Okay. What else you got?
How do you like our background music?
I like it.
All kinds of copyright problems here. All kinds
Who
of copyright
cares?
Problems.
No one's paying attention.
Speaking of copyright, here's a question for you. Yeah. Some back office crappy radio shit going on right now. They're Stitcher. You're familiar with Stitcher Radio Network, something or another?
No.
It's a walled garden podcast app. You have to agree to the license agreement to be put on their network. You have to...
Oh, wait. Before you get into that, did you see the thing from iTunes? They sent something about how...
I saw the email. I haven't read it yet.
We have to... Something about we have...
Album art
has to be a certain thing, and then something about the way our data is presented. Yeah, I don't think it's that big a deal. But
are they going to kick off like 50,000 podcasts off their podcast directory?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Yeah, I saw that just today on the way home. Same time I saw your email to Justin, so... I'll take a look at that. If it's just fixing some album art, we can fix some album art. Stitcher Radio Network had an acquaintance who's looking for our podcast on Stitcher. Couldn't find us because it's a walled garden. You have to actually agree to their terms of service to get put on there. Nice, Greg. Good job. Good job. Anyway. Man, we're going to get sued. I'm going to turn this down just a little bit, because if the volume is a certain level low...
All right. Wait, I'll tell you when to turn it up, but not yet.
Tell me when to turn it up, that's fine. Stitcher Radio Network. A friend of mine said, looking for us, couldn't find us. They found Craft Beer Academy, they couldn't find Craft Beer Radio. And he's like, Stitcher's a great app, we should try it. I looked in Stitcher, and I know that James Spencer from Basic Brewing promotes Stitcher. He's on the Stitcher Radio Network. So I read the terms of service, and there's things like you have to provide them promotional consideration. So at the end of the show, we'd have to say, you know, Craft Beer Radio is on the Stitcher Radio Network. We give them perpetual rights to reuse, redistribute, and cut our show for promotional purposes and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed a bit onerous.
Yep.
And James Spencer said, I mean, we do give our stuff out of the Creative Commons, so we're pretty free with how we use it anyway. It's kind of splitting hairs between Creative Commons use and Stitcher's use, but nonetheless.
We at least make the point that you have to ask us first.
James says he doesn't get very many downloads from Stitcher. And he got onto Stitcher. When Stitcher first came out, he emailed them and said, hey, can I get on Stitcher? So he never technically agreed to the terms of service. So, but he also said in the same tweet, he uses Stitcher and it's a really nice podcast app. It's a lot better than the Apple podcast app. Nice time for silence there. So I'm torn. I'm torn with the terms of service or Stitcher and whether it's worth getting on and things like that. It feels like Walmart. Feels like Walmart to me.
Well, I mean, I don't want to add any sponsorship to something that isn't giving us anything really useful. Right?
It's making us available. It's adding convenience for more people to find us. How many people? I don't know. And the thing is, like, the term service didn't mention. What happens if we fail to mention them in the post show?
Right.
You know, we do off the cuff outs, you know. What if we, forget to mention Stitcher Radio Network? And, we have to own the copyright to everything we broadcast, right? So all our fun ins and outs that we've been doing and all this voiceover stuff, so you know, the sound bed we've been doing, technically we can't put any of those shows on Stitcher, right?
Right, or things where we're, you know...
Well, there's fair use, right? But, I mean, the sound bed that we just ran, not fair use.
No.
So I think I'm going to skip Stitcher. I mean, I'd rather do what we're doing than...
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I don't see a use for Stitcher beyond...
getting 15 or 20 people.
Yeah, really. And
Greg's giving me very vague cues on, hey, turn up the levels on the sound bed. They give, like, better cues.
Sorry.
So, I guess no Stitcher for Craft Beer Radio.
No, I don't think it's useful. I don't think it... What will it get us, really, ultimately?
It's a walled garden podcast app, which
yeah.
pisses me off. Podcasts should not be walled garden. I'm like, I asked James, like, can you subscribe to podcast? Like, okay, so he uses Stitcher. How do you listen to us? You know, and I didn't ask him that question, but I'm curious. Does he switch to Apple's podcast app or what? Or does he... Not
really. I mean, you can download us via RSS. You can download us via a whole bunch of different ways. I mean, Apple's not the... I mean, Apple is obviously the easiest way to get to us because it's...
But apparently you can't add... Like in iTunes, you can add any old RSS feed to your iTunes, right? And subscribe to a podcast. Stitcher, you can't. So like we're not... No one who uses Stitcher listens to Craft Beer Radio.
Well, no one who uses Stitcher exclusively listens to Craft Beer Radio, is what you're saying. Not no one who listens to Stitcher. But, yeah, okay, so we're not available on Stitcher. Well, okay, some movies are only available on Netflix, and some movies are only available on Amazon Prime.
Unfortunately, we're not in that caliber of
media. No, but it's the same. It's the same thing, it's just a different focus, right?
Maybe I should email Stitcher and see if we can get put on without agreeing to the terms of service like James did.
Maybe. I mean, why not, right? I mean, it's worth a shot to ask.
But he did it right when they were starting up, and now they're established. Who knows if that avenue is still open.
Yeah.
But it might be worth a try.
Well, we could say... that would probably be too much of a bitch to add on a little Stitcher bit at the end of every podcast.
You know, most of the term service is probably just boilerplate and I'm blowing out of proportion. The real concern is, you know, we've taken to playing this copyrighted music for ins and outs and, you know, now sound beds.
Right. Well, just for today. And I think
just for today, even. Yeah. But, okay, so how do I manage that? All this stuff's on Stitcher except for episodes... 220 through 241, right. You know? Those ones have copyrighted material, you know? Like, oh, motherfucker, how am I going to manage all that shit, you know?
But the thing is, I mean, people are not going to go after us, period.
But we're...
We're way too small. They can't make any money off us. We don't make any
money. We're breaking Stitcher's terms of service if we post today's show with Rick Astley to Stitcher.
Yes. And that's
technically
too, that is too much of a burden.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, because we don't, because the problem is that we, A, we want to do what we want to do, and B, we don't have a whole department dedicated to making things for us should we want to do something that is technically not in our, like Jimmy Fallon could do a Rick Astley kind of deal, but he can't do Rick Astley unless he gets the rights. But he can. But he has the roots there to make a Rick Astley-like song. We don't have that. So, you know, since we're just doing this on our own, we're just doing this for fun, we're just doing this for everybody listening, it's not the same. There's such a wide berth there between where we are and where, like, Fallon is, where somebody like Fallon is, that, yeah, we don't... We'd fall somewhere in the very beginning of that middle area that it wouldn't really work out well for Stitcher, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing is to find other people violating that term, right? Like, I'm sure there's other small-time podcasts who use copyrighted material fleetingly like we do, you know, that are on Stitcher, right? And I just got to find those to say, hey...
Well, we were for the longest time afraid of using copyrighted material, and then we just figured, who gives a damn?
Yeah, maybe that was a horrible mistake, but yeah, I mean, I don't know, like, the ins and outs are kind of...
I've heard much more powerful, much more broadly listened to podcasts use copyrighted material just saying, fuck it, it's podcasting, it's the Wild Wild West, that's what we're doing.
But they might have ASCAP licenses, some of them.
No.
No, okay. You know, my question is... If we're doing it somewhat tongue in cheek, somewhat satire, is that almost fair use, or is that in fair use? You know, it's hard to tell. It's, you know, because we do talk about the intro music a little bit, really quickly.
Right.
That's almost fair use, right? If we're critiquing it or something like that.
Yes, that is fair use if we're critiquing it, actually. So, as long as we don't play the whole thing,
so
which we don't.
Let's critique all the last couple Sunbed songs. A lot of Pixies, right?
No.
No?
There was not a single Pixies song.
That song beforehand wasn't... I thought it was Pixies beforehand.
What, the Fuck the Pain Away song?
No. The one just before this song.
There was a song by a band called Love Psychedelico. There was a song by Pavement.
Oh, maybe the Pavement song was sounded very familiar.
This is actually Paranoid Android, but the YouTube version. So this is no Radiohead. This is all done by... This is some guy who compiled a list of all people who are doing Radiohead covers and made it into a big thing. And it sounds and is awesome. It really is great.
It sounds awesome if you like Radiohead. To me, it sounds like...
I love this song, and I think that this version... is awesome.
Find a YouTube video of like 8 hours of Rainstorm and let's play that. When you're talking about white noise and stuff like that, I found some awesome long videos of Rainstorms and I was listening to those at work. Because rain is basically white noise.
More variation. Yeah, rain is a little more variation. That's too much variation for me because that will distract me. The white noise is, yeah, I'm distracted by variation. If it's regular...
I like that it's a little more natural and not just...
The natural totally destroys me because that makes me concentrate on difference. I'm weird.
I'm not saying you are weird. I'm just saying,
I am weird.
I like the thunder and
I am fucking weird. Don't try to deny it. Don't try to make it sound
you
like I'm not
weirdo.
I'm not a fucking weirdo who's
are we gonna fight again? Are we gonna fight again? Yeah.
What I'm saying is that you should not make it. Don't make me seem like a normal person. I'm not. I'm fucked up in a whole bunch of different ways, and I don't need that to be acknowledged because otherwise, I'm gonna seem a lot more fucked up than I actually am.
You know, by doing the sound beds, that's even more shit for your database, right? People are going to document what songs were played in the sound bed at what times and shit.
That's a more interesting problem for me as an artist.
As an engineer, motherfucker.
I think that's a good place to end it.
Cheers.
Cheers. So the towers fell. Thank you. And the earth quake. Just a little taste of his vengeance. America, prepare for your fate. 'Cause when the trumpets sound, you will...